The following podcast may contain material not suitable for family listening. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Podcast 30. Everybody, hope everyone is doing well. You've got Jared Reimer. I'm the host of this program. We've got some articles coming up. We've also got some commentary from Michelle Dyer and AMW. I apologize it's taken this long for the podcast to be created. However, AMW took a while for me to get. Plus, we had some technical problems getting things recorded. And they were finally recorded. Our articles for this podcast deal with two 911 cases. We also deal with a Roger Bentley update, and we have a few other odds and ends. One of which deals with a six-year-old getting charged as a felon. We also have BSO story, clerk lifts apron, exposes himself to children, juvenile sex offender must tell parents of the fact that he is a sex offender, he's a juvenile. Let's see, what else do we got? We've got predators luring kids on two-way radios. And, of course, Roger Bentley's, stuff. We've got, 44 minutes of America's Most Wanted. And one of the suspects was caught shortly after the airing. He got 15 seconds of shame, and he was caught. So that was a good thing. Contact me, Jared, at codeamber.org. Check out the blog. We also, by the way, have news notes for the last month of Amber Alerts. We go back all the way through the end of April. So we've got all that coming up. And let's go ahead and just get started right here on Code Amber Podcast, podcast number 30. This is the Code Amber News and Notes update for the last month, folks. I have been very busy with this podcast, and I hope everyone has enjoyed all of the programming that you have listened to the past while. I have not had a chance to really do a blog update because we have posted so much. Neither have I done a news notes segment either. So at this time, I'm going to do that. But I'm going to also tell people that they may visit the blog and register themselves for commenting on any of the posts at any time at codeamber.wbby.us. And I suggest people do that because the blog has so many posts. Since the last time I did a blog update, I would take an hour to an hour and a half just to catch everyone up on the latest. But I will go through the previous Amber Alerts and let you know what's going on with this North Dakota case we told you about last time. So I'm going to go ahead and get started with that right away here on this podcast. We have had several Amber Alerts, and I am going to give those to you right now. The first one, which was just canceled, two were yesterday alone. Then we going back, and I'm going back all the way through the beginning of May, just to cover everybody, unless I remember where we left off. So we'll just have to wait and see. The first one is Jalene Neva Blount, spelled J-A-L-Y-N-N, next word N-E-V-A-E-H, and the final word is B-L-O-U-N-T. June 6, 2006, the Perry Police Department and the GBI canceled the Amber Alert after the child and suspect were located in Sarasota, Florida. The suspect was taken into custody and the child was unharmed. The GBI is the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. Guadalupe Medina, June 6, 2006, the Chicago Police Department and the state of Illinois canceled the Amber Alert after the child was located safe and the suspect in custody. They were both found in Chicago, Illinois. Guadalupe, G-U-A-D-A-L-U-P-E, Medina, M-E-D-I-N-A. The suspect was thought to be headed for Mexico, so we activated all across to Mexico for that case. We actually activated that Sunday evening Pacific time, and that was early Monday morning, June 5th, we activated, and the Amber Alert was active for about 24 hours. We put the date of the Amber Alert cancellation, just as an FYI for everybody. Susanna Salcedo, S-U-S-A-N-N-A, S-A-L-C-E-D-O. May 30th, 2006, the Washington State Police and the Lakewood Police Department canceled the Amber Alert after the child and suspect were found. We have no further details on where they were found, what was going on, and so forth. The Amber Alert was up, and it came down within minutes. This Amber Alert happened because the father was one of those who, I guess he was on a lot of medication or something, I'm not exactly sure. He would sometimes not be aware that he has the child with him, and he goes and does things. So they were concerned he was going to do something, so they issued the Amber Alert. They were found within the hour while we were activating this Amber Alert. Lillian Kohut, L-I-L-L-I-A-N-K-O-H-U-T. May 28th, 2006, the Park Hills Police Department, the state of Missouri, canceled the Amber Alert after the child and the mother were recovered in Johnson County, Illinois. The suspect is in custody. Nathaniel Thomas, N-A-T-H-A-N-I-E-L, Thomas, T-H-O-M-A-S. May 20th, the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Office and the California Highway Patrol canceled the Amber Alert on Friday night after the boy was recovered safe. The second victim, his aunt, was shot and killed. The suspect remains at large at this time. We actually almost canceled it that night, but we all went to bed, and I didn't see anything until morning time that the Amber Alert was canceled. So we let it run overnight just because we thought it didn't look good. I actually was out that night, so Bryant activated the Amber Alert. And when I caught up with him, he told me what was going on, and so forth. So, that is the deal with that Amber Alert right there. Marlene Brito, M-A-R-L-E-N-E, B-R-I-T-O, May 10th, 2006, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement and the Alachua County Sheriff's Office canceled the Amber Alert after the girl was found in Atlanta, Georgia. No further information is available at this time. I don't remember exactly, but I think we read somewhere more information about it, but I have not updated It sounds more familiar with those people who are familiar with the Adam Kirkert case, where the boy was on a camping trip for 4 days, and the father knew the guy was a convicted person because he met the guy in jail and so forth, and trusted him. And this case was like another one of those. We also have a story in regards to this case, which will shock everybody. It deals with a 911 operator who gave this guy a phone number to call instead of sending an officer to the location where the guy saw the suspect and the child. Otherwise, they would have been picked up 6 hours earlier than they were. So, that 911 operator has been terminated from her job and put on remediation. Brooke Lynn Ward, B-R-O-O-K dash L-Y-N-N-W-A-R-D. May 7th, 2006, the Jupiter Police Department and the Florida Department of Law Enforcement canceled the Amber Alert after the child was found safe. No further information is available at this time. Tamar Wyatt, T-A-M-A-R-W-Y-A-T-T, May 5th, 2006, the Millersville Police Department in the state of Tennessee canceled the Amber Alert on Friday morning after the child was located in Nashville. The suspect was taken into custody. Perla Hernandez, P-E-R-L-A-H-E-R-N-A-N-D-E-Z, May 5th, 2006. The Knox County Sheriff's Department and the state of Indiana canceled the Amber Alert early Friday morning after the child was located in Juarez, Mexico, and the suspect was taken into custody. Andrea Evans, A-N-D-R-E-A, E-V-A-N-S. April 27th, 2006, the Seymour Police Department in the state of Indiana canceled the Amber Alert on Thursday afternoon after the child was recovered safe and the suspect shot and killed. We are back to Jaxton Allen, which was April 26th, and I remember covering him before. We do have an update on the Amber Alert for the North Dakota girl by the name of Rachel Smith. The Amber Alert is still active. However, as of May 28th, 2006, the tickers in the XML feed were deactivated for the Amber Alert when we activated the Amber Alert on May 28th for Missouri. So it is now on the active alerts page, which is codeamber.org, and click on the current Amber Alerts at the top right of the screen on the JavaScript. The JavaScript set of links is all accessible. If you have any further questions about any of the Amber Alerts, give us a call. 866-824-7876. 866-824-7876. Let's move it along to our next portion of this podcast. This is the Code Amber Podcast. Podcast number 30.
6-year-old Florida. Girl charged with felony for kicking teacher's aide posted. 6:29 a.m. EDT May 31st, 2006 updated. 6:31 a.m. EDT May 31st, 2006 Naples, Florida. A 6-year-old special education student who kicked a Naples teacher's aide and spent several hours in juvenile jail is facing felony battery charges. Her mother, however, wants to know why the case has gone so far. Tacovia Allen suffers from behavioral problems and attends a special class at Lilly Elementary in Naples. According to an arrest report, on May 2nd, a teacher was trying to line up students to go to music class. Tacovia refused to go and kicked the teacher's aide in the ankle. After a discussion among school officials and two law enforcement officials called to the school, the girl was arrested. Tacovia was taken to juvenile jail and held there for several hours before being released to her mother. She is being charged with battery on a public education employee. It's possible she will enter a program that includes counseling. If she completes the program successfully, the charges could be dropped. 911 dispatcher relieved of duty. An Atlanta Police Department dispatcher has been relieved of her duties after botching a 911 Amber Alert call. Patrick Farrell saw Marlene Brito and Juan Martinez before the Amber Alert was issued. He saw them and thought they were acting weird in the parking lot of a Northwest Atlanta Waffle House. Leaving the restaurant, he heard the Amber Alert and called 911. "Yeah, I was calling about the Amber Alert that just went out from Florida," the 911 recording begins. "I was eating at a Waffle House and noticed a green minivan similar to a 94 Plymouth that had two Hispanics, a Hispanic male and a Hispanic female in the front seat, and they were acting kind of weird. The female was laying back and the male was acting shady. And I heard the Amber Alert. I didn't see if it had Florida tags or not, but they were acting kind of strange." "Well, do you want to speak to an officer?" the dispatcher asked. The dispatcher told Farrell, who was on the highway, that he needs to meet with an officer in person. Atlanta police say an officer should have been sent to that Waffle House parking lot immediately. Instead, the dispatcher suggested that Farrell leave a message at a different number. "Okay, hold on a moment. Sir, let me give you a number to call. It's 404-817-7895, the dispatcher said on the tape. That number only led to voicemail, so Farrell waited until he got home and called Florida authorities directly. They said that he gave them a huge lead. The dispatcher has been relieved of duty and sent to remediation, pending the outcome of an Atlanta police investigation. She could lose her job. LOCAL6.com. Attorneys for suspect in Lunsford case want confession thrown out posted. 6:31 a.m. EDT May 16, 2006 in Inverness, Florida. Attorneys for the man accused of raping and kidnapping Jessica Lunsford want their client's confession thrown out. John Evander Cowie, 47, was denied access to a lawyer before he admitted to the crime in March 2005, the motion stated. Cowie's attorneys also are asking that the media be barred from pretrial coverage. Cowie is accused of kidnapping, raping and killing the 9-year-old Homosassa girl, whose body was found last March behind a home the suspect shared with his sister. Cowie has pleaded not guilty to charges of premeditated murder, burglary, kidnapping and sexual battery. A hearing Friday is expected to address the defense motions. Copyright 2006 by the Associated Press. All rights reserved. This material may not be published, broadcast, rewritten or redistributed.
Detroit, Michigan, AP. Two 911 dispatchers who authorities say wrongly assumed it was a prank when a 5-year-old boy called to report that his mother had collapsed have been charged with neglect of duty by the time an officer arrived. The boy's 46-year-old mother was dead. "I understand they get quite a few crank calls, but you have to take it seriously when someone calls 911, Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy said Wednesday in announcing charges against Sharon Nichols, 43, and Terry Sutton, 47. They could get a year in jail if convicted of the misdemeanor. Worthy said the mother, Cheryl Turner, might be alive today had the dispatchers done their job correctly. The president of the dispatchers union did not immediately return the call for comment. Robert Turner, now 6, called 911 twice on February 20th to report that his mother had collapsed and needed medical care, but neither operator treated this as an emergency, the prosecutor said. No police car was sent after Nichols took the first call. The boy called again 3 hours later, and Sutton reacted by sending police out to discipline the child, and inform the parent that the youngster was dialing 911, where he said. Attorney Jeffrey Feger, who defended assisted suicide advocate Jack Kevorkian, had filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the city on behalf of the family. Feger said Robert's mother, who had an enlarged heart, would have survived if help had been sent immediately. After police investigated, Nichols received a 5-day suspension, and Sutton received 3 days. Both have returned to work, where he said. The prosecutor refused to say if the two should have been fired, but added, they should not be taking 911 calls.
BSO. Store clerk lifts apron, exposes himself to children detectives, say man also collected child pornography posted. 4:34 p.m. EDT May 17, 2006 updated. 4:39 p.m. EDT May 17, 2006 Broward County, Florida. Deputies say a supermarket clerk lifted his apron and exposed himself to little girls shopping with their mother, and detectives say the man's computer was loaded with pornographic images of children. A Weston mother was shopping with her daughters, ages 4 and 7, at the Publix store at 294 Indian Trace on the evening of April 6. Without any adults noticing, the children said that Chad Sogi, 23, had lifted his apron to expose his genitals 4 times as their mother shopped. The girls told their mother what had happened a few minutes later, but she speaks little English and did not report it to authorities. However, after discussing the alleged incident with her husband, the woman decided to go to Broward Sheriff's Office Weston Substation the next day to file a report. An investigation was begun, and detectives learned that the LEACH, Law Enforcement Against Child Harm, task force was also investigating Srogi. Publix officials supplied in-store images in which detectives say Srogi can be seen exposing himself to the girls. Publix fired Srogi and has cooperated in the investigation. Sex Crime and LEACH detectives searched Srogi's photo sharing account at www.ringo.com, based on a complaint from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Detectives said Srogi's account contained more than 500 images of children, most of them girls under 12 years of age, including some in diapers. Srogi gave detectives a statement admitting that he exposed himself in Publix, but claiming that he forgot to close his zipper and inadvertently touched himself because of an uncomfortable hygiene condition. Detectives said that they expect additional child pornography charges against Srogi. They are asking anyone with information that might help in the investigation to call the BSO Sex Crime Unit at 954-321-4240. Court. Juvenile sex offender must warn date's parents of case posted. 10:52 p.m. EDT May 16, 2006 Trenton, NJ, an appeals court on Tuesday, ordered a teenage sex offender to warn the parents of anyone he dates about his conviction until he turns 18. Lawyers with the New Jersey Office of the Public Defender, which represented the youth, said they will appeal to the state Supreme Court. Tuesday's decision upheld an earlier ruling. The 3-judge panel said that the unusual restriction placed on the teen did not violate the state's juvenile code or circumvent Megan's Law. Megan's Law establishes a registration and notification system for sex offenders. The law is named for 7-year-old Megan Kanka, a New Jersey girl who was raped and killed in 1994 by a twice-convicted sex offender. The defendant in Tuesday's case pleaded guilty in 2004 to committing a sex act against his 6-year-old half-sister when he was 14. His name and hometown have not been released because of rules protecting youthful offenders. As a condition of probation, the judge in the case mandated the boy to notify the parents of anyone he dates about his conviction until he is no longer a juvenile. Several lawyers questioned how probation officers could enforce the restriction, because by doing so, they would have to define dating. Commentary by Jessica Oso. I do wonder how they would enforce such a ruling, and know for sure that he's done so. All he would have to say in his defense is that he wasn't dating the person, therefore he felt there was no need to advise the parents. I think it's great that they are requiring him to make the parents aware that he is a convicted sex offender, but should really find some way to enforce this ruling. Feel free to include this on the podcast. LOCAL6.com Judge Jessica Lunsford slaying suspect will be tried in Citrus posted. 6:31 PM EDT June 5, 2006 updated. 6:34 PM EDT June 5, 2006 Inverness, Florida, the convicted sex offender charged with kidnapping, raping and killing 9-year Jessica Lunsford last year will be tried in Citrus County, but with jurors brought in from another county, a judge ruled Monday. Attorneys for John Evander Cowie had already convinced Circuit Judge Rick Howard that a fair jury could not be chosen from among Citrus County residents because of pervasive publicity about the case. Instead of moving the trial out of the county, Howard will have jurors imported from another county to be determined later. Howard said Cowie, 47, has a right to have his trial in Citrus County. Prosecutors are seeking the death penalty for Cowie, who has pleaded not guilty to charges of premeditated murder, burglary, kidnapping and sexual battery. The trial is scheduled July 10. Cowie was present at the hearing, wearing red jail scrubs with his ankles and wrists shackled. He sat impassively next to his attorneys, and did not speak. Also Monday, Howard denied a defense request to close further pretrial hearings to the media. Public defender Dan Lewin, trying to get Cowie's confessions thrown out, argued that more publicity about those statements this close to trial could taint the jury pool and otherwise violate his client's right to a fair trial. A hearing on that issue is set June 23. We're at a very critical stage here, because we're going to be airing Cowie's recorded statements 2 weeks before the trial starts, Lewin told the judge. But Howard agreed with Craig Thomas, an attorney for the Tampa Tribune, who argued that the public has a right to know how the case against Cowie is proceeding. Thomas also noted that Cowie's confessions have already been widely disseminated in the media. And, Thomas said, Howard has already protected Cowie's rights by agreeing to have outside jurors brought in. Investigators say Cowie abducted Jessica on February 23, 2005, carried her 150 yards to a mobile home he shared with other adults, raped her and then buried her alive in the yard. Cowie reportedly confessed March 18. A day later, the third grader's body was found stuffed into trash bags. In the confession, Cowie blamed drug use for the crimes. Lewin will argue that Cowie was denied access to a lawyer before he admitted to the crime. Outrage over Jessica's slaying prompted the Florida legislature to pass a bill establishing a mandatory sentence of 25 years to life behind bars for people convicted of certain sex crimes against children 11 and younger, with lifetime tracking by Global Positioning Satellite after they are freed. Copyright 2006 by the Associated Press. All rights reserved. This material may not be published, broadcast, rewritten or redistributed. This scares me cause I have these two-way radios in my home, however I usually give one to my daughter and keep one in the house. I do this so I can keep tabs on her when she is playing outside with her friends. Since we have so many trees in our backyard and the park, along with her friends' homes, are behind our house, I sometimes lose sight of her. These are great cause I can contact her and find out where she's wandered off to. Sometimes I can see her, but not her brother, and rather than freak out and run over to where they are, I can just contact her on the radio and find out if he's with her and why I can't see him near her. Still, this does scare me. Only on KFOX. Predators lure kids on two-way radios. 5 months ago, Bill Hall bought his preteen daughter's two-way radios, but he never imagined a predator would be listening on the other end. It happened one day, when Megan and Madison were playing hide and seek using the radios. They said a stranger suddenly intercepted on the other end. Dottie wanted to know what our name was, and he wanted to know where we lived, Megan Hall said. The girls told the man they weren't allowed to give out that information, but the man tried to assure the girls he could talk to them. Douglas Cruz's police told KFOX they are investigating predators who use all kinds of technology, including cellular phones, to contact children. A good percentage of our kids are walking around with cell phones, and people get their number, or they pass it around. We get cases that people get numbers calling them, posing as doctors or posing as a teacher, and it's a way they can get communications to that child, said Detective Greg Garcia, from Las Cruces Police Department. Dr. Garcia urged parents to monitor their children's activities, and to report anything suspicious to police. Gazette Online Roger Bentley's conviction appeal denied published. 6/1/2006 5 p.m. updated. 6/1/2006 5:14 p.m. by Associated Press, Associated Press Des Moines, Iowa. The Iowa Supreme Court has denied Roger Bentley's request to have his kidnapping and murder convictions reconsidered in district court because a juror acted inappropriately. The order, signed Wednesday by Justice Marcia Ternus, ends Bentley's first attempt to appeal his conviction earlier this year in the kidnapping and murder of 10-year-old Jetsetta Gage of Cedar Rapids. The Supreme Court still may hear a full appeal of Bentley's conviction once that appeal is filed. So far, Bentley's attorneys have filed only a notice of intent to appeal. Bentley, 38, is serving 2 life terms for the crimes. His appeal focused on whether the trial was compromised when a juror admitted conducting his own research at home on a book entered into evidence by defense attorneys. In post-trial interviews, a male juror told defense attorneys he used his home computer and the internet to learn more about the necromantic ritual book. Necromancy was mentioned late in the trial and involves the conjuring of spirits as a way to predict or influence the future. Defense attorneys used the book to explain how Bentley's DNA was found on the girl's body and to suggest that Bentley did not commit the slaying. In their appeal, defense attorneys argued the juror's independent research violated the judge's orders not to discuss or read about the case outside the courtroom. State lawyers said the juror's actions had no bearing on the jury's deliberations and said sending the matter back for a lower court would be a waste of time. Teresa Wilson, the public defender appointed to handle Bentley's appeal, did not immediately return phone messages today. Gage was reported missing March 24, 2005, from her home, and hours later authorities issued a statewide Amber Alert. Police, responding to a tip, found Bentley at an abandoned mobile home in rural Johnson County the next day, with blood on his clothes. While searching the trailer, investigators found Gage's body inside a bathroom cabinet, naked and bound with a plastic bag taped over her head. Forensic experts determined Gage was sexually assaulted and died of suffocation. During the trial, prosecutors used testimony to show Bentley was at the Gage house fixing a family vehicle the day she disappeared. Forensic experts also testified that Bentley's DNA matched blood and semen found on the girl's body. A jury deliberated for a little more than 2 hours before finding Bentley guilty of kidnapping and first-degree murder.
All right, folks, this is being recorded on Thursday. That's April the 8th. April? What? Whoa.
I think you mean to say June.
I meant June, yes. I'm so far ahead of behind myself. I don't know what it... I'm screwed up. Jared Reimer here. Podcast number 30. Michelle Tyre's with me.
Hello, everybody.
Oh, man. I did the week in review, the month in review, actually, with all the Amber Alerts, which ran about 11 minutes. We played some articles. Now we're going to do some commentary. And then we are going to play AMW.
Yep.
So if the computer will allow me to do this, that is.
Yeah, really. Okay, so where are we starting tonight?
Well, the fact that I was going to check the time on my watch now said it's 12 o'clock a.m., which it's not.
Oh, great.
Where do we want to start, Michelle? You want to start with the six-year-old?
Yeah, we can start there. Basically, what I have to say about this is this is a warning flag that goes up for any child in the public school system that is disabled. I mean, this child is 6 years old. She's got either some kind of behavioral disorder or some kind of problem. And the teacher obviously did something to provoke this child, because how is a six-year-old going to, you know, I mean, I know kids today are really smarter than most kids used to be or have always been, but I don't know. I just, you know, when you're a six-year-old child and you're, you know, suffering from emotional and behavioral problems, and you're in a special education class in the public school system, I don't know. I think that this child was provoked in some way, and the teacher won't admit to it. But I also think that there's a real issue and a real problem in the public school system in general, where a lot of the time, even though you have people in the public school system that are trained in special education, that they basically, you know, are working in a system and an environment that won't allow them to give the kind of training and special attention that kids like this need. So even if you are a special education teacher and you come into the situation, or the child, you know, the children are brought into that situation, it's still an environment where basically the surroundings don't allow for, you know, proper training and education for these kinds of situations. I'm all for kids being mainstreamed in the public school system, but I think there's a real issue here when a child can't even function around other kids that have either similar problems or other problems, and then the teachers that are teaching them are basically losing their patience or don't have the kind of, you know, ongoing training themselves to keep up with what's going on, or just not have any real clue. And you would think that a person that is a special education instructor would know the difference and would know what to do in certain situations, but, you know, I really wonder about the training of some of these people, or if some of these people are even qualified for the job, so, or if they even have the right personality for the job. So, you know, that you know, to me, it's very disturbing. And I think if any parent that has a child in the public school system that has a disability of any kind should really take notice of that that whole story, because there are so many kids out there that are not being given an adequate education to begin with, and on top of it, they're, you know, put in situations that will upset them, that will provoke them, you know, by people who are supposedly trained to deal with things. I mean, even most special education instructors are trained in general situations that, you know, involve persons with disabilities, but there, you know, there are more disabilities out there than just the ones that, you know, most people, you know about, or some of the more common disabilities, you know, so, you know, that's a real issue. I mean, nobody regards an emotional disorder or behavioral disorder as a disability, but it can be disabling for the person that's dealing with it. But if you're a person like this that, you know, is only trained to work with people who have physical problems, or you know, might have you know, be, you know, slow learners, or even mentally challenged, then you're not going to be trained to deal with more complex issues, like a person who, in this case, a six-year-old child that, you know, may or may not have the capability to even function in group settings or, you know, what have you, or may not have the capability to mesh with the kids around them or to, you know, function in a learning environment that isn't as individualized as, say, an occupational therapist would be to give them. So, I mean, that's just like, you know, autistic children, they need specialized training if they are autistic in order to deal with their disabling situation, or a person who might have, you know, like neuromuscular diseases may not be, you know, basically, you know, the people that deal with that, it's so specialized in a specialized situation. You know, I mean, that's just like, you know, these schools for the deaf and blind, you know, you may have someone that's deaf and blind, but they also may be wheelchair bound. So, you know, I mean, there's so many multiple variables and multiple situations that, you know, aren't being considered by some of these general special education instructors. And I think that's probably the issue here. So, I don't know. What do you think, Jared?
I'm not sure, really, Michelle. I read that article, and I didn't really know what to think.
Well, it's just downright sad, because anybody looking at that, especially anybody who understands how or what, you know, should be happening in a situation like that would go, well, gee, you know, how many six-year-olds are really going to think to slap their teachers around unless that child's been provoked in some way or was frustrated and the teacher didn't know how to properly deal with the situation? I mean, look at all these daycare providers that abuse these kids that they are entrusted with. And daycare providers have to go through special training and they got to be licensed and this sort of bit. So, just because someone has the letters behind their name doesn't mean they're necessarily emotionally and mentally capable of handling the job in question. And you have to love that kind of work to really be able to do your job well and to be able to not get stressed out. And I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, even with something you love and, you know, even if you have the personality for a particular job, you're not always going to have a perfect day every day. So even a job that you love, it's going to be, you know, situations where certain days are going to be frustrating. So, you know, I mean, and so if you're a person that is, you know, finding out that you're incapable of handling certain situations or don't know what to do, my advice to those people is, admit that to yourself instead of allowing yourself to become so overwhelmed and so frustrated that you become either violent or provoking someone else, in this case, a child, to become violent. You know, children learn violence. They don't just inherit violence. You know, violence is a learned practice. And, you know, children mimic what adults do. And so, I mean, we don't know what this child's home life is like. We don't know what her parents are like. So, you know, there's a lot of variables there, too. But I do think that we need to consider how that teacher is teaching and what she's doing and how she's presenting herself to these kids.
Right.
Let's see. Next. What shall we talk about next?
Well, let's move along to another file so that we make sure this does not this does not turn into one of these where we're going to lose files. And
yeah,
I think that's what I'm going to do. For the podcast's sake, this is only going to be affected in the recording, so I will make sure it's edited, of course, Michelle. when I go through this, because I'm going to put music behind all of this, so all of this is going to be edited out.
Okay.
Our next topic is going to cover the 911 incidents. Since we had tried to do this earlier, we had another 911 story update dealing with the 6-year-old who called 911 like he was taught to do because his mother was not responding to any motion or anything, and the 911 operators, two or three of them, I forget how many were involved, said that he was playing on the phone. The mother eventually died, and the 911 operators were relieved of duty. The first article you heard was dealing with the case of Marlene Brito, who was spotted in Georgia, and the 911 operator told the caller to dial a 404 number. So Michelle, I will be right back. I'll let you get started with that, as I think a cat is meowing outside my door. I'll be right back. Right. Go ahead and get started. Those are your topics, and the floor is yours.
Okay, great. Here's the deal, folks. We teach our kids to dial 911, and we talk all the time about how children should know those three numbers. Why? Because our kids, if they aren't taught this, when they get in trouble, where are they going to turn? And, you know, there are situations where kids did not know what to dial or where to turn, and things went wrong. Well, in this case, the parents of this 6-year-old boy, you know, taught him to dial 911, as, you know, children should know. And the operator on the other end of the phone, and this child made two calls, okay? Two different women with two different dispatchers with the same result. The child calls up 911, says, "My mom isn't moving." Now, what the 911 operator should have done is she should have probed this child for information. She didn't do it. Same with the second dispatcher. She should have probed this child for information. Can you go and ask if she's breathing? Will she open her eyes? Are her eyes open? You know, and you know, there are simple things that you could say to a child to ask that child so that that child can give you some real clues and some pointers. You know, I mean, a child can tell you, especially a 6-year-old can tell you whether or not somebody's bleeding. They can tell you whether or not somebody's breathing. They can tell you whether or not, you know, there's, you know, a clear liquid coming out of someone's ears or mouth or nose. You know, they can tell you, you know, did mommy fall and hurt herself? Did mommy hurt her head? Did mommy, you know, hurt herself anywhere else? Did someone hurt mommy, or did mommy hurt herself? Is mommy sick, you know? Well, no, she just won't wake up. Well, okay, you know, tell me why you think she won't wake up. I don't know. She gives herself uses a needle every day to help her feel better, and today she didn't think to use her needle, or she used her needle and it made her sick. And I'm referring to people who are diabetic, not people using IV drugs. But, you know, my basic point is that in situations where a child is, you know, taught to call 911 because a parent is in trouble, or if the child happens to be by his or herself and doesn't have an adult around, that child should be able to call 911 and not be basically accused of, you know, pulling pranks or a joke. Your job as the 911 dispatcher is not to judge the validity of the phone call. This child calls 911. Both operators tell this child, well, if you don't stop playing on the phone, you're going to be in serious trouble. And here this kid, 6 years old, his mom is dead on the floor. He's not only going to have to deal with his dead mom and how to internalize that information, but then he's going to have to deal with the fear that's created when another adult, somebody that he is trained by his parents to trust, is telling him that, well, if you don't stop playing around on the phone, I'm going to send the police over there and you're going to be in big trouble. You know, I mean, what kind of responsible person is that? You know, you're trained as a 911 dispatcher, as a member of the EMS team, to be one of the first responders. I mean, that wouldn't be like, you know, if I was in a car accident and, you know, I call 911 or, you know, say, you know, I was in a car accident, but I'm blind. I can't see. I don't know where I'm at. I don't know, you know, whether anybody is awake or is alive or dead. And the dispatcher on the other end of the phone is like telling me, you're blind, but you're in a car accident. What were you trying to do, drive or something? Or tell me, well, you know, you're just, you know, fooling around on the phone. And, you know, people are dying in that vehicle, and they always talk about the golden hour, folks. You know, I mean, this golden hour came and went for this lady. And, you know, she probably would have, as a matter of fact, I think it was noted that she probably would have survived if help had gotten to her in time. Well, as it turned out, this lady, both these women, because it was two separate women, two separate 911 dispatchers, both of them were, basically both of them are still on the job. They're, you know, awaiting trial. You know, they're supposedly going to get, you know, up to a year in jail for some misdemeanor charge of some sort or other. I can't remember now what that misdemeanor charge is. But basically, the bottom line is they got a slap on the wrist, and that really ticks me off because these people are trained to be first responders. I mean, if I don't know CPR, and I'm, you know, relying on the dispatcher to tell me what to do, and what if that dispatcher doesn't know CPR? Or what if they aren't updated on the latest, you know, the latest methods that are used in, you know, CPR and rescue breathing and that kind of stuff? You know, if they're not trained and somebody does something wrong, you know, because the person in question is, like, you know, guiding them through because they don't know what they're doing, they're depending on that 911 dispatcher to tell them the right information. Or in the case of, you know, 911, you call 911 and the dispatcher, and this is kind of going to lead into the next thing, you call 911, you say, okay, and this took place, folks. We had an Amber Alert where the suspect and the child went from Florida to Georgia in a green car. The person that saw the car and the suspect and the person that in this case the child that was kidnapped, you know, they saw these, you know, folks in the parking lot of an IHOP restaurant or Waffle House or something, I can't remember. Anyway, the bottom line is this. This guy sees this car, this is subject of an Amber Alert, calls 911. The 911 dispatcher is like, oh, well, we'll get a cop out there, but we're going to send the cop to talk to you. Instead of sending the cop to try to find this car, what happens? The 911 dispatcher not only says, oh, we're going to send a cop out there to talk to you, but here's a phone number you call. And he, you know, the 911 dispatcher gives this guy a phone number that leaves the voicemail. What's the point in that? You know, if you read, you know, like, so like if you get, these, you know, Amber Alert messages emailed to you either in your email box or sent to your cell phone, or if you hear them on the radio or see them on a billboard somewhere, it always says call 911 if you see anything, if you, you know of anybody that's involved in this and you have information, or if you, you know, happen to know anything, or, you know, whatever. They always tell you, call this number or call 911. Well, most people are going to remember to call 911 because that's the number you call for emergencies. It just kills me. They're like, well, you know, would you like to say, you know, talk to a police officer? Well, I would like the police officer to come out here and check out, you know, where these people are going. They're very specific, very suspicious. You know, the driver is suspicious, the person in the vehicle with the driver is suspicious, the car is definitely suspicious, and I think that, you know, they match the description of that has been the subject of an Amber Alert. What the dispatcher should have done is said, okay, you know, stay where you're at. Don't try to approach the suspect. Wait where you're at. Keep an eye on things, and we're going to send somebody out. We'll stay on the line with you until they show up. That's the way it's supposed to be, folks. That was what that person was supposed to do. Well, they send the cop out, but they send the police officer out to talk to the person that called. In the meantime, the suspect and the person that's being kidnapped are just allowed to walk away, or, you know, allowed to leave the scene, which continues to put the child in danger, and the suspect is, you know, continuing to do, you know, what that suspect is doing. God only knows what that was. You know, I mean, that irks me. You know, I have some EMS training, and you know, I took first aid a few years back. Actually, it was like 13 years ago when I took first aid course. And, you know, we were trained to be, you know, the very first responders on any scene to any emergency. That, you know, that's the whole system, the way it works, you know, emergency medical system. Emergency responder type person. You know, you know, you're right there. You're on the scene. You're at the scene of the accident, at the scene of whatever. What is your first response going to be? Well, your first response is going to be, well, okay, I've got my cell phone. I'm going to call 911 because that's what you're trained to do. So, you know, we have some serious issues with the 911 system in this country. And, you know, I mean, the majority of, probably about 98% of the 911 dispatchers out there do their jobs, do them properly, you know, and work really hard. They work some of the weirdest hours. They deal with a lot of the just incredible stress and frustration every day. And you know, they deal with probably more high-stress situations and even most air traffic controllers sometimes. But, you know, you get this, you know, 2% out here that ruin the whole system for everybody else and, you know, basically, you know, put a black eye on the whole system. So, you know, kind of leads to, you know, some of this stuff we've been talking about. I think people, when they apply for a job or they, you know, basically go into any particular field, any kind of employment, they really need to examine themselves and do some serious soul searching about whether or not they even want a job like this or that. You know, don't let the pay, you know, the money that you might get per week, per hour, whatever, be the only deciding factor in your selection of a job, because you could be in a job, do a job, be hired for that job, be qualified for that job, have all the credentials, have all of the head knowledge, but if you don't have the emotional capability to handle that job, you know, just like with the, you know, special education teacher, you know, a 911 dispatcher takes a very special kind of person to do a job like that. So, you know, there seems to be a running theme here with people who don't totally know how to do their jobs right. And, you know, so I think that, you know, as we think about all of this and consider all this, anybody going into whatever particular field of study or, in this case, field of interest, whatever job you wish to do, know what kind of job you're wanting to do and, you know, do research. Check into it. Make sure that it's the kind of job that you think you can handle emotionally and everything else. Because if you can't handle even the least little bit of stress attached to that particular job, and that's not to say that there isn't going to be stress and that there aren't going to be bad days and good, you know, good days come and bad days come, and, you know, but if you can't handle the ups and downs of a particular job and the requirements that go along with it, you know, the emotional demand it might have on you, then don't do it. And, you know, that you really have to, you know, each person has to, like, you know, stop and think about that, you know, for themselves. So that's the basic gist of that, folks. I think that if we pick up the phone and dial 911, I mean, for the most part, we're going to get what we should get, a person on the other end of the phone that's going to be our connection to some help and a source of comfort and assistance in times of a severe emergency. But, you know, if you get situations like these where the dispatchers either don't know what they're doing, can't find where you live, can't find the location of the emergency in question, or whatever the case may be, you know, these are people that shouldn't be working in a job like that. So that's all I have to say about that.
You know, it makes me wonder, Michelle. It's like I was telling you off the air earlier. Great job, by the way.
Thank you.
Remember I was telling you how, you know, I'm trying to apply for jobs that I know I can do, and how Code Amber, even though we're having some problems, which you already know about, which I'm not going to go into on the podcast, this company is the only company that has had faith in me. And you want to talk about a job that is stressful.
Oh, yeah. But the rewards outweigh the stress. I mean, there is a lot of stress, and there's a lot of things that we hear about, read about, you know, but we find information and situations that if you take each one of them, like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of articles that we read every week that deal with, you know, situations, that each situation could be a potential Amber Alert, you know, domestic violence, child abuse, sexual abuse. You name it. These are issues that when you read this material, yeah, it can be very overwhelming, very upsetting, and it makes you feel like, well, you know, gee, I mean, this stuff is happening every day of the week, and you were reading about stuff that seems to be happening every day of the week. But when you stop to think about it, when you sift through all the information and you find what you find, it really, in all honesty, when you stop to think about it, with all the Amber Alerts that have been activated since the inception of the Amber Alert system in general, as opposed to all of the kids that, you know, have wound up missing and dead without the Amber Alert system, the rewards really do outweigh some of the stress that goes along with a job like this. And, you know, for me, it's, you know, I mean, I realize that you know, for you, it's, you know, it's like you said, the one place where you felt and see the acceptance. And for me, it's like a way of giving back to you and a way of just giving back, period, for all the help that you've done for me. But yeah, you know, Code Amber is a great organization, and I'm not just saying that because we're doing a podcast. I'm saying it because it's true, because we do things here at Code Amber that the state activation systems can't do and or are not in a position to do. So we fill a void. We fill a gap. We sort of bridge the gap. And when we put out, you know, the Amber Alerts and such, you know, all the news outlets pick it up, and, you know, I mean, it's just, it is a great organization. And the bottom line is, folks, Code Amber and the Amber Alert Consortium needs funding. That's the bottom line. You know, of course, there's a lot of people out there, a lot of charities out there, a lot of nonprofits and for profits, you know, I mean, I don't know how you classify Code Amber, but
Code Amber is not a nonprofit. Code Amber is a for-profit, and it is run by BigHits.com, which is Bryant's parent company. But it cannot survive on the income Bryant makes with the web hosting and web statistical analysis and things that he provides his customers.
Yeah, I think about the fact that, you know, for the price of a Big Mac at McDonald's, or for the price of, you know, going to the movie theater, or, you know, or in this case, people, I don't know how many people go to movie theaters anymore when you can buy a podcast off the internet and watch movies on your computer, but... But
well,
even yet,
Bryant,
still, char- you know,
Bryant charges, I think, $9 a night. He does, you know, provide it for free, but, you know, if you pay, you know, $9.95, I think it is, per month, you get extra.
Right.
But, you know, that's as much as a Fillmore box.
Yeah.
But, you know, this actually leads into our next segment, because we're actually going to be talking in the next two segments about some of the recent Amber Alert stuff. And our next segment will deal with a non-Amber Alert deal. And the final segment will deal with an Amber Alert update to a previous Amber Alert from last year. So are we ready to move on to our next segment?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Our next segment deals with the Jessica Lunsford case. That was not an Amber Alert. It was reported as a missing child. And that was also on the heels of the Carly Brusha case, see podcast 21. And our very first podcast, podcast number one, for all the Carly Brusha coverage. Again, Michelle Dyer's with me. And after this, we're going to go right into the Iowa case of Jetsetta Gage.
Yeah, these situations are why we do what we do. Whether it's a Code Amber or an Amber Alert situation or a missing child, it doesn't really matter. At the end of the day, we do for the kids. And we're here to save kids' lives, and that's what this is about. What was so upsetting about the whole, you know, Jessica Lunsford's situation is, as Jared just stated, you know, that was right on the heels of Carly Brugsha, and it seemed like we were having a rash of these, you know, missing kids and kids ending up murdered, that people just became so freaked out. And what happened was everybody was like, you know, we've got to do something, we've got to do something. So, you know, a lot of laws were slammed through, you know, the State House of Representatives and, you know, this kind of bit. And now we're getting to where we're having to tweak some of these laws a little bit, which I do think there needs to be some tweaking in some areas. But, you know, by and large, it's great to see that, you know, we're working toward making, you know, this work a little better for our kids. The issue with Jessica Lunsford is so disturbing in the way that the court system handles cases in general. How many, you know, times have we seen these high-profile cases like, you know, the Michael Jackson trial, the Scott Peterson trial, and the O.J. Simpson trials. These are, you know, such high-profile cases that the, you know, the whole world and God and everybody knew what was happening. Where are you going to find a jury that doesn't know what's going on and doesn't watch the news or read the internet? Is just beyond me. You know, but the way the court system is, you know, we're still living like we're in the 19th and 18th and 19th century. We're in the 21st century, everybody. We need to, you know, start considering that, you know, people are going to know what's going on, and it's a little hard now to keep people from not knowing what's going on, and we'll get into that with the whole Jessica Gage issue. But by and large, you know, they wanted to throw Roger, I mean, not the, I'm getting ahead of myself.
They want to throw Roger Bentley out, too.
Yeah, well, you know, but basically, you know, this fellow that raped, murdered, and kidnapped, you know, Jessica Lunsford, you know, he's like, well, you know, we need to get this fellow's confession thrown out because he didn't have a lawyer present when he confessed to the crime. And, you know, you're only required to have a lawyer present, if I'm not mistaken, when you are being accused, or in this case, when, you know, when you're brought to the police station, the police know that you committed this crime, and they are, you know, interrogating you, you know, about that crime, and trying to, you know, get information about that crime, specific details, specific information. That's when you are allowed to have a lawyer present. But if somebody confesses to the crime, I'm not sure all of the things that totally happened behind this fellow's confession. But, you know, what I do know is that, you know, I don't care what you say about, well, there was an attorney present, no attorney was present, you know, during questioning and blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm sorry, but if you have enough forensic evidence and you have, you know, eyewitness testimony and, you know, things of this nature that, you know, put that person at the scene of the crime. I mean, that was what nailed it with Carly Brugsha's, you know, situation. You know, Joseph Smith was, you know, he had his DNA all over her. And, you know, that, you know, I don't care what anybody says, well, I was high on drugs and I didn't know what I was doing, or, you know, in this case, I didn't have a lawyer present. Whoops, sorry about that.
That's okay.
I didn't have, you know, access to legal counsel. Well, You know what?
Then why was why was your dick in her anyway?
Well, not only that, but what kills me about, and I mean, I understand that, you know, the first job of any defense attorney is to defend their client. But when there's no defense for a client in a case like this, what do you do but come up with every loophole in the book to try to get a case thrown out of court? Now, if you can, you know, really prove that, you know, well, there's some real issue there, like police officers' misuse of power and authority, or in the case of, you know, a police officer that, you know, would be regarded as, illegal search and seizure, and, you know, things that you can prove that truly violate a person's constitutional rights, you know, then I could see it. But in the case of this, I'm sorry, but, you know, no attorney present during questioning is, that's sort of like what they call color of law, and there's just so many blurred lines of demarcation there. But the real thing that kind of really just ticks me off, like what I was just, you know, saying, that, you know, they wanted to move the trial, and you always get this, well, we need to have a change of venue because our client's not going to get a fair trial because in the county that the trial's taking place in, you're not going to find a person in your jury pool that isn't going to know. It's just like what I was saying. You're talking about a high-profile case, and, you know, again, I have to point back to the Scott Peterson trial because that was a surefire example. They moved everything, you know, they did this, they did that, you know, brought different people in. The man was convicted anyway. And, you know, how can you prove one way or another that a jury's knowledge or lack thereof is going to influence their decision when you've got 12 people making a decision, 12 different people with, you know, 12 different personalities, you know, unless you're a clone, there's no two people alike in this world, exactly alike in every, you know, in every aspect. So you may have 12 people in a jury pool that might know about the case, but their perspective on it is going to be different. Each person's perspective and you know, person's background, you know, is going to also play a factor in the decision that's made. So, you know, what's the difference, you know? In the case of the, you know, Jessica Lunsford deal, you know, they kept they're keeping the trial, which starts, July 10th. They're keeping the trial in Citrus County here in Florida, but, you know, they're bringing in a jury from outside the county. You know, okay, everybody all over the state of Florida and all over the country knew about this. You know, what's the difference? You know, you're not going to be able to change the outcome if the prosecution has an open and shut case. And, you know, they can present that in court. The burden of proof is on, you know, the individual in question here that committed the crime. You know, the burden of proof is on him and his attorney to prove he didn't do it, just like the burden of proof is on the prosecution to prove that he did. And you have to present that to a jury. Now, that leads right into the whole Roger Bentley and Jet Set Engaged thing. Because, that's right. necromancy is a form of witchcraft and sorcery. And, you know, even if somebody got on their computer and looked it up when they were a part of the trial and the jury pool and during the trial what's going on, let's see, what is the rule, Jared? You know, you,
They basically said you cannot listen to the news during the trial.
Right.
Which
But going on the internet and doing a Google search on necromancy is not reading the news. Okay.
They're trying to say that
we need to have the conviction overturned because there's a juror in the jury that, you know, during the trial, after the trial, they admitted that they did this. Well,
so?
You know, there are a lot of jurors that come out after a trial and admit things and say, you know, what their thoughts were. But, you know, this juror, you know, you know, he or she, whoever the person was that did this, all they really simply wanted to do was get access to some additional information on necromancy. They didn't go and, you know, contact the prosecution and sit down with the prosecution and say to them, okay, tell me, you know, give me some additional inside information that's separate or a different from or has anything to do with this case directly. You know, it's not like the person sat down and read news articles about the case in question. This person went to the internet, Googled necromancy, and read up on the subject, generally speaking, to try to get some handle on, generally speaking, a mentality or the mentality that goes into or is involved with that particular, well, I won't call it a discipline, that particular belief system. You know, that's like, okay, you know, if you're, you know, if you got a Satanist on trial and the Satanist has committed, you know, rape and murder and this and that, and you're a juror and you go to the internet, oh, I want to look up Satanism. Well, you know, you're going to pull up a lot of stuff that has nothing to do with that case. You know, you're going to pull up a lot of stuff that has to do with past cases. You're going to pull up, you know, stuff that has to do with, you know, every element that has to do with that, and maybe even things that don't relate. So, you know, I don't think that this would have even had any bearing on the outcome of the case if it was made known that this juror did this during the trial, and then if that juror was thrown out, you know, the evidence and the, you know, the information presented and all the things that went on, you know, in the forensics and such, was totally an open and shut case. There was, you know, I mean, how else, okay, Bentley, are you going to explain why she's curled up and stuffed inside of a cabinet, you know, with a noose around her neck, strangled to death? Explain that, Bentley. It was in your mobile home. You know, I mean, oh, what, did she just get there by osmosis? I don't think so. You know, I mean, there's just certain things that, you know, defy logic if you try to say he didn't do it. You know, it's like, okay, let's use some common sense. You know, I mean, you know, any juror that has any common sense, if they have any, which, you know, most of them do, you know, want to be informed. And I think it's important for jurors to be informed. The more informed a juror is, the more, you know, likely it is that they're going to make a decision based on knowledge and understanding rather than based on their belief systems that they adhere to, or, you know, their own personal value system that they go by, although, you know, those are, you know, also going to be, you know, factors that play a role because, you know, people are human beings and they, you know, we all have, you know, thoughts and feelings and experiences that, you know, influence the way we do things and our responses and reactions to things. But, you know, by and large, if you're on a jury and you're deciding someone's fate, I know if it was me, I would want to be well informed. I would want to have, you know, more information. And if I felt like, you know, the attorneys and whatnot were not giving me enough information, and if I'm in a position where I can't ask questions, God, you know, I would be going to the web or going somewhere to try to learn a little bit more about something so that I can make an informed decision. But, you know, this whole thing about, you know, anymore, how are you going to find people that don't know what's going on, that don't follow the news, that don't have access to information, that don't have access to the web, that don't have, unless you live in a cave, you're not going to know, you know, or in this case, unless you live in a cave, you're not going to be in situations where you're not going to know what's going on. You know, if you're, you know, living in a cave, you know, cut yourself off from everybody and everything all the time, you're not going to be, you know, that ideal juror that the court system thinks that you should be. So, you know, we need to rethink how we look at the court system, how we look at trials, how we look at, you know, all of the elements that go into, you know, how a trial is put together. You know, some of these trials are long and drawn out, protracted, or in the case of, you know, Carly Bruce and Joseph Smith, you know, the family members and whatnot had to wait almost 2 years from the time that Carly Brusha was raped, murdered, and everything, till the time when, you know, Joseph Smith was finally, you know, brought to trial and to sit in a courtroom to, you know, face his accusers.
Which he showed no remorse for.
Going, you know, once they got the trial going, it was open. It was such an open shut case. It was done and over with in 8 days.
Yeah, and he showed no remorse for it. He just sat. Well, didn't they say he was doodling on a piece of paper or something the whole time?
Yeah, he was sitting there doodling on a piece of paper, and the only time he shed any tears was when he was convicted. Oh, boo-hoo, cry, wah. I'm so sorry. I was on drugs. You know, well, you know, there's a lot of people on drugs that don't rape and murder 11-year-old kids, you know. You know, and believe me, I'm no, you know, supporter of drug abuse, but, you know, there's a lot of drug addicts and people who, you know, recreationally use drugs that don't hurt anybody. So that's, you know, total crap.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, trying to say he was on drugs, okay, whatever. How do you explain what happened to Jessica Lunsford? You know, what was behind that crap? You know, I mean, and then his sister, you know, okay, he's living with his sister. Now, I mean, not that I have anything wrong with him living with his sister, but I just, you know, that whole family seemed to me like they were a little cuckoo. You know, it just seemed like a little off. You know, it's like, well, you know, what was it that it came out that she was protecting him? She knew about it? And she was protecting him, if I remember correctly. I think that was what came up about that with the Jessica Lunsford. As far as, you know, Roger Bentley is concerned, you know, I was saying this for the longest time, you know, the Bentleys were abusing Jet Setta Gage years before she was murdered. And that was a known fact, and nothing was done about it. The court system didn't do anything. The justice system didn't do anything. I think, wasn't it like 3.5-4 years before she was murdered? In that time period, both Bentley brothers, was his name David and Roger? David?
David's not the right name.
I can't remember the brother's name, but you had Roger and then his brother, and they were both on trial.
The other one hasn't gone on trial yet.
Yeah. See, this is what I'm saying, you know. The court system is so backlogged with these cases that, you know, it's a situation where, you know, these people are, like, on trial, you know, or just waiting, you know, sitting, waiting in the wings for, you know, their
The other one was gonna. The other one was going to go on trial for the molestation of Jet Setta, but the other one killed Jitsetta before he went on trial.
Right. So, I mean, his whole deal with, well, you know, we need to have it thrown out because this person, you know, was reading up on necromancy on the internet. Well, you know, that's immaterial, mister. You and your brother abused this little girl before she, you know, years before, you know, she was killed. And that's a known fact. You know, that's a known fact. So, you know, that's just total crap. You know, that right there is complete bull. You know, I'm sorry, but, you know, I believe in innocent before proven guilty, you know, because that's the way, you know, we're supposed to think. But when you look at a situation like this where you just, you know this person's guilty, there's no question about it, but their defense attorney is coming up with all these loopholes in the system. We need to start closing some of these loopholes. I understand that those loopholes are for the protection of a person who's innocent, but if you're truly innocent of a crime, you know, there are ways to prove your innocence. You don't need loopholes in the system. You get to where you need loopholes in the system, you're guilty of sin and you're going to jail, and that's where you belong. You're going to the death chamber if that's what, you know, has been decided for you. So that, you know, I don't know. I just think that, you know, this whole idea of how we handle juries and how we handle the court system and, you know, and this kind of thing, we could speed things up a lot faster too, I think, if we didn't focus so much on what person, you know, is qualified to be on a jury and what a juror does in their time of service. If we just focused on getting the trial, you know, going and getting it complete and doing what needs to be done, we might speed things up and you won't have this issue. So that, you know, that's pretty much all I really have to say about all that. So,
okay.
Just the bottom line, folks.
Was there anything else you wanted to say before I cut the file loose?
Just that, you know, basically in a nutshell, folks, it's important for people to know what they want out of life, and B, it's important for us to rethink the way that we do things, because, you know, we live in a day and a time where, you know, so much is different from the way things have always been done. And, you know, we just need to, you know, really stop and look at changing some elements in the system, and really looking at how things are done and re-examining. You know, one thing I want to kind of bring up, there's been an issue with how sex offenders are not being tracked when they move from state to state, and how they will just, like, you know, leave one area and then go into another location and not register, and so they can't keep track of them. It's hard to police it when these people move around. So, you know, and I bring this up because of a woman who was killed, and granted, this isn't Code Amber related, but it has to do with sex offenders. That woman who was killed at that university in South Carolina.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that's a situation where the guy that killed her, you know, was a sex offender who was convicted of other crimes in the past, including here in Florida. But he moved around and evaded the authorities by moving around and not registering as a sex offender, and so then he, you know, went ahead and, you know, basically committed another crime. And you know, the issue is, how do we monitor these people? Yeah, sure, they may have served their time and in prison and this and that, but, you know, sex crimes are very specialized, and in the, and you know, sex offenders are sick, you know, I don't mean that in a derogatory, we sort of say it in a derogatory fashion, but these are people that are legitimately
fucked
screwed up in the head. Yeah, they're legitimately screwed up in the head and can't help with, you know, they can't help themselves. It's an obsessive compulsive type disorder that they're engaged in and having to deal with. So, you know, it's also an issue of power and control. And when you are obsessive compulsive and you suffer from an addiction issue, that's not something you can just shut off like a switch. And if you're a sociopath, psychopath, I mean, and these are all, these are all pathological disorders that, you know, psychiatrists treat these people with medication, but, you know, there's only so much you can do. You know, there's no medication for sociopaths and psychopaths. You know, these people have no conscience, and, you know, that is truly a mental disorder. And so these people are incapable of functioning in our society in a way that would allow them to have the freedoms that the rest of us enjoy. So we really have to stop and think about that, folks. And you know, my mom said, well, maybe they should brand them or put a microchip in them to, you know, track them, or that they should have a nationwide database. You know, of course, the sex offender databases, I think they're all like each individual state, but anybody can go to any state website and look up in a particular location in the country where sex offenders are and how to, you know, figure out where they're located. But there does need to be a situation where if a person moves into a particular area, you know, and, you know, that it alerts the police or alerts somebody that, well, okay, a new sex offender is now living in this area. But, of course, you know, you have to come up with the database to hold that information. You have to be able to monitor it. And so I don't know what solution there is for something like that, but that's kind of like been the recent talk in the news in the last couple of days since this story really broke about this university student who was killed in, I think it was North Carolina where that happened at. But she was raped and killed by a registered sex offender, but he wasn't registered in North Carolina where the murder took place. And he was residing there from what I understand. So, but that was kind of something I wanted to throw out there for people to think about.
Okay.
Other than that, I didn't have anything else to really add.
All right. Well, thanks a bunch, Michelle, as always.
Sure.
We haven't had you on in a long time.
I know.
Seems like months.
Well, it has been at least a couple.
Yeah. All right, we'll go ahead and move along with our next portion of our podcast. If anyone has any questions or comments for Michelle, how can they get a hold of her?
Well, anybody can reach me through my website, www.racing4theblind.wbby.us, or you can, you know, just, you can email me through there. It's probably the easiest way to do it, so people won't have to try to remember a bunch of, you know, information. You can email me, my phone number's up there. You know, so, you know, that's kind of a deal. I want to let people know, too, I've going to be starting my own. Actually, I've already done one to kind of introduce people. And you can go up to gcast.com and register your podcatcher, your podcatcher set up, or just download the file. I guess you can just download them.
You can download
your
them.
Hard drive.
It will be gcast.com/u/Michelle Dyer. And that's the homepage
right.
of Michelle's page. Her website will have that URL here in the next day or two, because I need to update it with some things anyway. So y'all stay tuned for that. Probably by the time this podcast is released, her website will have already been updated.
Right.
With all
and
of this information.
The only other thing is that tonight, at the time that this recording has been done or is being done,
mm-hmm.
Being concluded, tonight I had been on another podcast, and you might want to go up to www.k as in kite, g as in green, k as in kite, i as in igloo, radio, r-a-d-i-o, if I can spell, .com, and look for an interview I did up there with some folks up there. It's auto racing related, and they interviewed me about being a writer and being blind and all that. So I've been busy with a couple different things. So you know, feel free to check that stuff out and drop me a line or whatever. And with that, I'd like to thank Jared for having me on.
All right, we'll go ahead and move along to our next segment of our podcast. This is podcast number 30. Thank you, Michelle.
Sure.
The manhunt for June 3rd is now in progress. To date, you have captured 891 fugitives. Coming up, the clues that could lead to your next capture. Now, join the manhunt with John Walsh.
Okay, the lights go on, a car pulls over. It happens hundreds of times a day on highways all over the country. Sergeant Greg Martin was a cop here in North Carolina. He kept the peace in a town that's famous for its friendly people. So when he pulled over a truck one night for a routine traffic stop, there was no reason for concern. He'd done it dozens of times. But as we all know, there's no such thing as routine when you're a cop.
Yadkin County, North Carolina, October 5th, 1996, 2:30 a.m. State Trooper Van Tate is on graveyard duty. It's a quiet Saturday night. Trooper Tate's shift is winding down when he hears a scratchy radio transmission. He recognizes the voice. It's an old friend, Sergeant Greg Martin, an officer in the nearby town of Jonesville.
I could just pick up bits and pieces, but I heard the county calling.
I'm out at 61 West Virginia, 4, South David, 69.
1061 meant that Sergeant Martin was pulling over a suspicious vehicle. 4 Sam David 629. That's the license plate.
I got on my radio and I called him and he answered up.
Ten-4 meant Sergeant Martin was okay, but 25 meant he wanted some backup. No one knew what Greg Martin was walking into. Closer to his friend's location, Interstate 77, just outside Jonesville, radio dispatch lost all communications with Sergeant Martin.
At first glance, I didn't see another vehicle. So I crossed the median. The county was still trying to raid.
I can't make radio contact.
When I got out of the car, I didn't see Greg anywhere, so I just started calling his name. Greg? Greg! When I got past the driver's door, I looked to the right, and that's where I saw Greg laying on the shoulder of the roadway, dripping with blood.
His As Trooper Tate approached Sergeant Martin, he realized there was nothing he could do. Greg Martin was wearing his bulletproof vest, but it made no difference. The killer had shot him several times in the head.
The right side of his head was gone. I mean, it had been blown over. I don't know an easier way to put it.
Sergeant Martin left behind a wife and three children, the youngest just 7 months old. Today, that youngest son is nine and still waiting for justice for a father he barely met. A few days before the truck was stolen, a salesman had shown it to two men. Men who police believe came back and stole the vehicle. They'd never been identified. After the murder, the truck was dumped in the parking lot of the Lucia textile plant in the nearby town of Elkin. Investigators believe the killer or killers then stole a Lucia company van, drove about 100 miles south, and abandoned the van at a Home Depot on Interstate 85 in Gastonia. That's where the trail went cold.
Hi, I'm Lee Hammond. I'm from Kansas City.
We brought in renowned forensic artist Lee Hammond to work with the salesman and create new and better sketches of the suspect. When we showed you these sketches, our hotline lit up with tips, and a nine-year-old cold case started heating up. But the best tip about these sketches told police that something about the drawings wasn't right.
I came upon what I thought was an car accident.
This tipster, who does not want to be identified, told police he was traveling on Interstate 77 with his wife the morning that Sergeant Greg Martin was killed. They were heading out early for a vacation and passed right by the crime scene.
We noticed a van passing us from a manufacturing facility in my hometown. The logo on the van is what made me notice. The driver looked at me as he was passing me, and I looked at him. I did go to the authorities. I don't know whether I wasn't taken seriously. Maybe I didn't know what to tell them, and they didn't know what to ask me at the time.
What we're going to do is that we're going to try to help remind you of what was going on 9 years ago. Think about all the different types of events and things you were seeing, and we're going to relax you.
Dr. Michael Teague, a forensic psychologist, took the witness down the same interstate in the middle of the night. They stopped near the spot where the tipster spotted the van. Then a police sketch artist went to work on the hypnotized witness.
Describe the hat to me.
After hours of work, this is the result.
I was very surprised at the job that the sketch artist had done. It seemed like he was able to take a picture out of my head.
Police believe this new sketch shows the man who murdered Sergeant Greg Martin. They need you to help identify him.
The person we're looking for that murdered Greg Martin is a very violent individual. This individual is a career criminal.
Sergeant Martin's murder is North Carolina's only unsolved homicide involving an officer. Let's hope the new sketch will finally lead to some answers. If you can help police identify this man, please give us a call right now at 1-800-CRIME-TV.
Now, this is a case every cop here in North Carolina wants solved. So if you know anything at all about the murder of Sergeant Greg Martin, have the guts to make that call to our hotline. And I guarantee you can remain anonymous. We need to get this fallen officer some justice. Now, we're just getting started with tonight's manhunt, so keep it right here. We'll be right back.
Coming up, if you run into this guy at your neighborhood grocery store, watch out. He's toxic.
I couldn't see it, but I breathe.
And he's deadly. And later, 1 year ago, she went to Aruba with her best friend, Natalie Holloway.
We got in touch with a safe island that we just thought that everyone we met was a friendly, good person.
Now she's finally coming forward with the story of what she saw the night Natalie vanished and who she saw.
We thought he was a very nice young man. We had a very good impression of him.
Their 15 seconds of shame. Paul Everhart served time for sexually assaulting a young girl in Baltimore, then was supposed to register as a sex offender. Instead, he disappeared. He was last seen in California, maybe traveling with a carnival. With a face like this, it should be easy to identify James McDowell, but he's been charged with identity theft. McDowell's an avid poker player, and cops say you might spot his poker face in Washington or another western state. Police in North Carolina say Antonio Alvarez slashed his roommate's throat after an argument, then dismembered the body. Alvarez may be hiding in New York near the Canadian border, could be working in construction. Michael Berger tried to bilk investors out of hundreds of millions of dollars. He took off before a judge in New York could sentence him. Berger loves fishing and boats. Cops believe he's hiding out someplace warm. They've had their 15 seconds of shame, you know what to do. If you've seen any of these fugitives, call our hotline at 1-800-CRIME-TV. Most robbers like to work where there aren't many people around. To case out of store and wait, striking early in the morning or late at night. But up next, Ed Miller has the latest on a gang who bring terror to the aisles of brightly lit supermarkets in the middle of the day, boldly making their moves in a sea of innocent shoppers.
Can you check out a customer now, Tim, please, sir?
A grocery store in East Dallas, Texas. On a hunch, a store security officer points his cameras at a strange-looking man.
You know, he's wearing a woman's wig. Kind of hanging around, and his whole demeanor was odd.
The hunch proves right. The man takes out a gun. And that white can, it's pepper spray. His target, an armored car courier.
They told me to do what you told me. Pull off your glasses. I pull off my glasses. He sprayed me one time. I turned to try to get the deal out of my eyes, and he sprayed me a second time. Couldn't see, I couldn't breathe.
The attacker grabs the bags of cash and takes off running, while store employees scramble to call 911.
So I started chasing the elevator, y'all.
Because he was heading for the back door.
Yes, he went for the back door. He went through it. The alarm went off. The door was closed. When I got here, I went to open it, and it would only open this much.
Because?
Because there was a pallet wedged against the back door.
He knew what he was doing.
Yes, he knew what he was doing. He did his homework. It was part of his plan.
Just 30 days later, in January 2003, police believe the same robber strikes again. But this time, it would be 1,400 miles away in Southern California. And the results would be deadly. As we've reenacted, at first the robber fires a warning shot into the ceiling. Then the man points his gun directly at the driver's head and fires.
I said, oh my God, the driver's been shot. He went straight to the ground.
What about the customers in the store?
They were screaming and yelling. I told him, get down, get down. I said, don't worry, help's on its way. There was nothing I could do to save him.
28-year-old Brinks driver Corey Medlock died almost immediately. Cops say he was killed simply because he did not hand over the money fast enough. Over the next few months, cops believe this robber pulled off several more stick-ups with the help of a female and a male accomplice who frequently drove the getaway car. And after the murder, the robber seemed to grow more and more aggressive. In Burleson, Texas, he not only pepper sprayed the armored car courier, but 24 customers as well.
Even with the makeup and the wig, his eyes are still exposed. We believe he's spraying people in the face and continues to do this so nobody can identify him.
In all of these robberies, the MO has been the same. Wig, pepper spray, and then escape out the back door. But on January 24th of this year, here at this Walmart in Garland, Texas, there was still another pepper spray robbery. But this time, there was something very different about the way these guys got their loot.
The robber is a completely different individual than the earlier robber. So who is it? It's probably the partner of the earlier robber.
Unfortunately, we do not have good pictures of the robber's partners. But these older surveillance video images have given us a good look at the original gunman's face. That could be why the gang decided to make the change. And the front man isn't the only thing they've changed.
The MO is different than the earlier robbery. The robber is waiting for the courier outside of the stores rather than committing the robbery inside the stores.
The one thing that has not changed is the terror the gang inflicts.
Just give it up, give it up. Once I heard him say that, I just dropped the bag. He took out a can of pepper spray and just sprayed him in the face.
When he pulls the gun out and points it right at you, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking my life is over. Here they're teaching us to go home. And I did the right thing, I gave it to him. And I'm alive.
The next victims might not be so lucky. So please, if you recognize this man or know anything about the accomplices he's working with, call our hotline at 1-800-CRIME-TV.
As you can see, this gang is getting bolder and bolder, and it doesn't look like they plan to stop their terror anytime soon. So we gotta stop it for them. Go to AMW.com to take a good look at this suspect and read up on the case. If you know anything that can help cops grab him and his accomplices, please leave your tip online. And of course, you can always call our hotline. And I guarantee you that you can remain anonymous. Now, stay with us. We'll be right back.
Up next, soon we're in paradise. Hide a predator.
Individuals like this live in their own little fantasy world. They're sick, they're demented.
He messed with the wrong turkey. I'm not gonna rest until he is where he belongs.
It's June, summer's coming on, and that means a lot of families are preparing their vacations. But while you're relaxing, remember to keep an eye on your kids. Because as John Turchin reports, if you're not watching them, maybe someone else is.
There's a predator in paradise. Among the smiles and laughter in Orlando, he's stalking your child.
This guy went from, say, once a month to, say, twice a month, to every other day, to every day.
There have been dozens of sexual assaults. The youngest victim, just 9. The job of taking this predator down went to an elite team of cops from the Orange County Sheriff's Office and the Orlando Police Department.
Let's make it personal and get this guy.
The cover of the pool area, been down by the pool, be in the stairwells. We'll have some people out on the balcony. We're going to be walking around the hotel. We're also going to cover the parking lot. So if he shows up, we want to be everywhere, have everything covered.
While they couldn't ID him, investigators did catch a glimpse of their man in this hotel security tape. Just minutes after he walked past the hotel cameras, cops say he attacked a 10-year-old girl visiting from England.
This is what motivates us to find that sick freak and put him in jail.
Then it happened again. Another young girl attacked, this time in this YMCA parking lot. The teenager, whom we'll call Carla, was on her cell phone talking to her father when she became the predator's next target.
All of a sudden, like, he just came up and he grabbed me. He forced his hands into my pants from the back, and, you know, he penetrated me.
But Carla fought back. She repeatedly hit the attacker until she managed to break free. She ran one way, he the other. But not before Carla got a good look at his face, good enough to help police make this sketch. But even more importantly, she saw the vehicle he jumped into. That gave the team of investigators a major lead in their manhunt.
She gave a description of a red Ford Explorer with tan interior. And the big thing she told us that really helped us out, you know, later on, was that they had no tag on it. The tag was removed.
For the first time, police knew how their suspect was getting around. As part of the undercover team continued to stake out hotels, others immediately began searching for the Explorer. They hoped the predator hadn't been smart enough to dump it. The surveillance went on for weeks, with no red Explorer. Then,
I observed the red Ford Explorer pull in. The vehicle pulls into a spot, and I observed there's no tag on the vehicle. So, okay, this is definitely the guy we're looking for. At that point, I get on the radio and call for all the other units to come in.
For the next 30 minutes, the undercover cops watched as the suspect cruised through one hotel parking lot after another.
This is our vehicle. Enough is enough. I couldn't let him do it. I couldn't let another child be the victim of him.
Although they believed the man they were watching was their suspect, the detectives had no proof. That meant they couldn't take him down. Yet.
We couldn't arrest him at that time just because we didn't have a positive identification from a victim.
All right, looks like he's going to pull into another hotel parking lot.
But there was something they could do.
Go ahead and duck traffic stop on that red Ford Explorer.
Remember, the vehicle had no license plate, so the undercover team called it a marked patrol car. Using the missing plates as an excuse, uniformed officers pulled the suspect over.
I see your driver's license registration.
He had to hand over his driver's license. Now cops finally knew who he was.
Joshua Emmanuel, V-E-I-T-A.
Emmanuel Carlos Vega, a Brazilian citizen, here in the States on a work visa. After getting a citation, Vega drove off with no idea he was being trailed. Meanwhile, armed with the picture from his driver's license, detectives quickly arranged a photo lineup for several victims. Carla, the teenager who was attacked in the YMCA parking lot, knew right away they had the right guy.
Is this the guy?
That's him.
No doubt in your mind?
No doubt in my mind.
The positive ID gave police what they needed. Vega was charged with kidnapping a child, sexual battery, lewd and lascivious molestation, and rape.
I'm glad that I could be the one to put him behind bars. Well, he was.
That's right, was, but isn't anymore. A judge, Carolyn Freeman, decided it would be safe to place Vega on house arrest with a monitoring device attached to his ankle. Judge Freeman has refused to publicly comment on the case, but her decision stunned the team of detectives who worked so hard to take an accused predator off the street.
All the hard work we put in for the judge to sit there and say she finds it more important for him to run his family business than all the innocent victims that he's taking care of? Come on, that's ridiculous.
Ridiculous. And a big, big mistake. 6 weeks after being allowed to go home, Vega cut off his monitoring device and walked away. He hasn't been seen since.
Here are the clues that can track this creep down. Vega made his living cleaning newly made homes and maybe working as a janitor. He's an avid surfer and has always lived close to the water. He spends a lot of time at the gym working out. And he's in the martial arts.
He's competed in jiu-jitsu tournaments since he was a kid.
If you know where Emmanuel Vega is hiding, call our hotline at 1-800-CRIME-TV.
Now, this story absolutely drives me nuts. Vega committed a serious, serious crime, and the judge treats it like he's some kind of solid citizen. When are the people in charge going to take these sex offenders seriously? Earlier this month, it was revealed that pedophiles on parole in California were being housed by the state in motels just blocks from Disneyland. Motels filled with kids on vacation with their families. How could that happen? Well, at least there's something we can do. Help cops track down Emmanuel Vega one more time. So if you've seen Vega or know where he's hiding, please stand up and do the right thing. Call our hotline right now. Now stay with us. We'll be right back.
One year ago this week, Natalie Holloway disappeared in Aruba.
A judge ordered three suspects to be held in custody.
You may think you know the story, but later tonight, you'll hear for the first time from someone who was there when it happened.
For the first 2 months after the trip, I would wake up crying, having nightmares. After it, and the flashbacks would be so vivid, it was just so hard to even deal with.
Cops in Metairie, Louisiana, just outside of New Orleans, hover above a crime scene, searching for clues in a cold-blooded murder. Just hours earlier, on May 23rd, they found the body of 51-year-old Sandra Adams, dumped on a dirt road. Police say she's been raped and killed after someone snatched her from a nearby park. Witnesses reported seeing a white Ford SUV with a flat tire fleeing the crime scene. Cops jumped on the lead and tracked a matching vehicle, flat tire and all, to this nearby apartment complex. The SUV belonged to Edmundo Cerda Anima, a carpenter who came to town to work on homes ravaged by Hurricane Katrina. Police say they found enough evidence to charge Cerda Anima with Sandra's murder. Bodies disappeared. Cops think Cerda Anima fled to Wichita, Kansas, and he may now be driving a blue 1993 Ford F-150 pickup truck with a Kansas tag WJT-384. If you've seen Edmundo Cerda Anima, please call us right now. Remember this guy? A police car dash cam caught Richard McNair talking his way past an unsuspecting cop just hours after he escaped from a federal lockup in Pollock, Louisiana on April 5th.
You got a cell phone with you?
No, hell, I don't have.
It wasn't the first time this convicted killer wormed his way out of the hands of police, and it wouldn't be the last. 3 weeks later, McNair had another close encounter with the law. Police in British Columbia, Canada say McNair was behind the wheel of a stolen car they pulled over. He took off on foot and they couldn't catch him. They left behind a digital camera full of these self-portraits. Police think he was trying to make a fake ID. Since then, U.S. Marshals say McNair may have altered his look again. But there's one thing he can't change. He's got really bad allergies. When he escaped, he had an infected molar, which was causing a sinus infection. Because he's so dangerous, the U.S. Marshals have put this cold-blooded killer on their 15 most wanted list. We gotta help them get him back behind bars before someone else becomes his victim. So, if you've seen Richard McNair, call our hotline. On Memorial Day, as our nation honored its war dead, Short Park
dark and suburban Milwaukee became a battlefield. Hundreds of families enjoying a holiday picnic ran for their lives as a gunman ran into the crowded park and opened fire.
There were people crying, kids crying.
Mr. Shockey, you mean this is our neighborhood park?
When the smoke cleared, two men lay dead and a woman was critically injured. Cops quickly had a suspect, the woman's estranged husband, Octaviano Juarez Coro. They say he wanted revenge on her for leaving him and didn't care who got hurt in the process. But he didn't stick around to find out who he did hurt. After the shooting, Juarez Coro disappeared. He was last seen driving a 2003 Pontiac Grand Am with Wisconsin license plate 386KCL, maybe trying to make it to Mexico. Seen Octaviano Juarez Coro, call our hotline at 1-800-CRIME-TV. Three-year-old Rochelle Smith disappeared from her Minot, North Dakota home on May 23rd. Call if you've seen her. Holloway has been missing now for a year. We've all seen the headlines in the newspapers and magazines, watched the reports on TV. They've even picked up the latest twist in the case on the internet. For some, the media blitz turned a human tragedy into just another soundbite. But for Natalie's friends and family, the drumbeat of news had a very different effect. Rick Siegel asked some of the people who know her best how they've coped with a year of sorrow.
In the small town of Meridian, Mississippi, everyone knows Dave Holloway, and they also know the hell he's been through over the past year.
A lot of people have said that could have been my daughter.
The world knows Natalie Holloway and this case.
You know, I still probably get 50 to 100 emails a day.
While Natalie Holloway's story has played out in the international media, emotional interviews with her mother, Beth Twitty, have come to symbolize the family's anguish.
I think it's the dishonesty that has been coming out of that island since May 31st.
Dave Holloway mostly stayed in the background while his ex-wife became the public voice for their tragedy. But tonight, we'll get to know a father's pain and take you into his search for answers. How many jobs are you holding down?
At least three.
What are those?
Well, my job as an insurance agent, and then my job as, a father and a parent, and then the third job is trying to figure out what happened in Aruba.
Tonight, he's getting some new help in that search. For the first time, one of Natalie's best friends, Lee Ashford Broughton, is coming forward to tell her story publicly. Lee was with Natalie the night she vanished, and while the recollections are painful, she hopes they'll jog someone's memory and bring out information that somehow has been overlooked or forgotten.
For the first 2 months after the trip, I would wake up crying, having nightmares after it, and the flashbacks would just be so vivid. The flashbacks only come now when I'm in a party kind of scene, and most of the time just go home. The emotional pain of talking about Natalie was way too great to do any kind of interviews. I was just so hurt and sad to have Natalie gone, and America's Most Wanted, after watching their shows a lot, they've actually been able to find people, and so that's
Lee remembers how she and Natalie thought their senior class graduation trip would be a vacation in paradise. And at first, it was.
Arriving into Aruba, we were all very excited, you know, away from home on this gorgeous island. And I was with Natalie most of the time. We got the impression it was a very safe island, that we just thought that everyone we met was a friendly, good person. And the majority were.
But as everyone knows, on their last night on the island, things went very wrong. Lee, Natalie, and their friends went dancing at a popular night spot. A local teenager, Joran Vandersloot, also showed up. Lee and Natalie had met him earlier that day at a casino.
I know for a fact that Natalie had never met him prior to that. There was a lot of talk about that, but she had not. We thought he was a very nice young man. We had a very good impression of him. And so we asked him to, if he was going out that night.
But at closing time, Lee went back to their hotel room at the Holiday Inn and went straight to bed. She had no idea that Natalie had left in a car with Joran and two of his friends. The next morning, Lee discovered that Natalie's bed had never been slept in.
We immediately just assumed that she had slept in a bed with one of our other girlfriends. And so we got on the phone and started dialing people's rooms. And everyone kept on saying, we thought that she was with so-and-so.
Lee began to panic when she discovered Natalie wasn't with any of their friends.
I just felt really nauseous and immediately started bawling when I had to go and tell the police that were in the hotel description of Natalie and what we had been doing. That's when I started to get really, really worried.
May 30th, 2005, I was seeing the back patio, enjoying Memorial Day weekend, and he gets that dreadful call.
And so Dave Holloway's ordeal began. The story, every twist and turn of it, filled the airwaves. Reliable information seemed impossible to come by, and Dave seesawed from one emotional extreme to another.
We had heard rumors through some of the leaks in the police department that Joran had confessed and was leading the police to where Natalie's body was located.
But the next day,
the Ruben spokesperson said, well, no, this is not a homicide investigation. We still think she's alive.
You did that roller coaster up high, down low, time and time again.
Exactly.
What's going on inside you during this roller coaster ride?
Your heart's up in your throat, and you're in total panic, and it's just almost non-functional. It's hard to go through.
Dave couldn't just sit by and wait for answers that never came, so he went looking for them. We joined him in Aruba last October as he was getting ready to watch an American volunteer group, Texas Equisearch, begin searching the waters there for Natalie's remains. Aruba's Deputy Police Commissioner, Gerald Dompig, told us exactly where to look.
Everybody who knows the waters is that you have to go further than 500 meters out.
But this year can only reach down to 150 feet, and the Aruban authorities wouldn't issue the documents allowing Equisearch to bring in equipment that can search deeper.
Gerald Dompig stated that he just didn't have the time to sit down and write these little letters.
What's the effect of that?
The search is over. It's a huge disappointment that we cannot do basically what we promised this family we'd do.
Everything just stopped and we just got kind of stonewalled.
Month after month, setback after setback, but Dave Holloway would not, could not give in to despair. Neither could we, but we wondered, what could we do to help Dave and the rest of Natalie's family that hasn't already been done?
Okay. Look!
In March, we got our chance. Aruban authorities invited us back to their island to work with the Dutch federal police, who produce a weekly TV crime-fighting show much like ours. They were producing an entire program on the Holloway case for broadcast in Holland and Aruba.
They got Sabina and Nathalie Holloway. Do you sell them in our club?
In Aruba, they don't have a program like America's Most Wanted or our program.
Hey, Natalie, what are you doing to us? You're crazy. Get out of the car.
No, really. They'll bring me back to the hotel.
We're hoping by getting on America's Most Wanted is that American tourists who've been here realize that they might have seen something that is really important. And let's hope we can try and put this case together in the Netherlands, Aruba, and America.
At AMW.com, you can see more of the Dutch TV reenactment, as well as a full transcript of their show containing lots of clues. Since the Dutch TV show aired in April, police have arrested, then released, two more people in connection with the case.
No.
After the year he's been through, it was disappointing, but not surprising for Dave Holloway.
1 year, what would you want Natalie to know?
I think she already knows that we're not going to give up on her.
Let's not let another year go by before Dave gets some answers. If you know anything that can help solve this case, call our hotline at 1-800-CRIME-TV.
Officer Robert Targus died when an accused drunk driver ran through a red light and struck his patrol motorcycle. Officer Targus had dedicated his career to combating drunk drivers. In his 12 years on the force, he made more than 1,000 DUI arrests. He leaves behind his wife.
Children as they were enjoying their family vacations. Well, there's a lot your kids can do to stay safe on the road this summer, and it's the subject of tonight's Kids Safety Tips, sponsored by Walmart.
Freeze!
Hold on, come on back.
When checking into a hotel, work as a team. Make sure your kids are responsible for something.
I've got to check in first. So Billy, you watch the bags. Timmy, you watch Billy. Olivia, you watch the boys. Mom, you watch everyone. Everyone watch me. Okay?
Okay.
Hey, look, kids. Come over here. I want to show you something.
What?
It's the emergency plan.
And as soon as you arrive, go over an escape plan. In case of a fire or other emergency.
Okay, kids, what do you want to do now?
I want to go to the White House. No way, we're going to the NCC.
Can I take a nap? Okay, everybody, slow down. I have a list.
Parents, create an itinerary so you not only get all the fun stuff in, but you keep track of where everyone is supposed to be.
So what do you guys want to do next?
I want to go to Lincoln Memorial. I want to get some ice. Oh, hold on, both of you.
Parents, whether your kids are running off to see the sights or getting ice cream, don't let them go alone. Divide and conquer.
Come here. Come on. This is what we're going to do. I'll go take Timmy to get the ice cream. You go to the Lincoln Memorial, and then I'll go check on Olivia.
And we'll meet right there.
Okay, that sounds great.
Okay.
All right. What? You forget your keys?
Tell your kids to never answer a hotel room door without first checking to see who's on the other side.
Who is it?
Maintenance.
If the person claims to work for the hotel, tell your child to call the front desk.
Hello?
See if someone is scheduled to come by.
Can you come back later?
Sure, that's fine, man.
Hey, there they are. Hey, everybody, come over here. Look, we're going to see a lot of things today, go to a lot of different places. Anybody gets lost, this is our meeting spot.
Parents, always have a meeting place everyone knows about, in case you get separated from your kids.
Right here, sir.
Remember, summer vacation should be fun and relaxing, but it takes a little bit of hard work to make them safe. I hope every one of you gets to take some time off with your family this summer. And before you pack, you and your kids can review vacation safety tips together by logging on to amw.com/kids. Me and my friends in the Lookout League are online with fun, interactive activities that'll keep you sharp and keep you safe. Now, let's take one more look at tonight's cases. This is the sketch of a man police want to question in the shooting death of a police officer in Yadkin County, North Carolina, on October 5th, 1996. This gunman is accused of shooting and killing an armored car driver during a robbery in Riverside, California, and is believed to have held up several other armored car drivers in Texas. And James McDowell has been charged with identity theft. McDowell is an avid poker player, and cops say he may be hiding out west, possibly in Washington State. I'm John Wall. Thanks a lot for watching tonight. And remember, you can make a difference.